Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very pleased to say we have Tom Wheatland on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Frankfurt School in Exile. I have a friend who, as a very young child, happened to meet Herbert Marcuse. Upon meeting Marcuse, he said, "Marcuse, Marcuse, you have such a big head." Now, that's a very funny anecdote, but it turns out that Marcuse did not have a big head. He did become extraordinarily famous as a member of the Frankfurt School, but even as he did, he disavowed his own fame. This is one of the things you will learn in Tom Wheatland's terrific book about the Frankfurt School in exile, especially in the United States. I really enjoyed talking to Tom today, and I think that you will enjoy listening to us talk. Here's the interview. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thank you. How are you?
You're well? That's good. I'm very well. It's a beautiful day here in Iowa. We're going to have thunder showers later today, but for now, it's very nice. Now, you're in Worcester, is that correct?
That's right, yep. And It's very overcast and unseasonably cold and rainy for this time of year, but hopefully it'll be a little bit more summer-like soon.
Well, it happens. I should tell our listeners that we're talking to Tom Wheatland today, and we'll be discussing his terrific new book, The Frankfurt School in Exile. As I was telling Tom before the interview began, this is one of my pet topics. I was an undergraduate right after the New Left had become a thing. This was in the 80s, and I very much look back on that time and said, I wish I could have been alive then. Now that I've read Tom's book, I'm more confused about what I thought than ever. Because there are you point out some terrific things about the reaction of the Frankfurt School guys or the Horkheimer Circle guys about their own fame. And I didn't know any of this, and we'll come to it in the interview, but I thought it was absolutely a terrific part of the book, how ambivalent they were about the fact that the New York Times had made them into gurus.
Yeah.
And much to their credit, I would say that they were disturbed by this. But anyway, Tom, let me ask you to begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I grew up just outside of Portland, Maine, which is a gorgeous place to live, and I had a very—I went to a terrific high school that gave me this really broad and very firm academic foundation, and then went to college at Brown University in Providence. Mm-hmm. And after the high school education that I had, Brown was the perfect place to go. So I started there in the late 80s and graduated in 91. And the culture wars, the reverberations of the culture wars were still being intensely felt on campus. And there was a really wonderfully engaging intellectual atmosphere on campus. The semester would begin, and all anybody was talking about is what courses you were taking and with who, because the curriculum was wide open and you could take anything that you wanted to. So with the kind of foundation that I had going in, it was a place where I felt like I was really able to take advantage of what was there. And so, I tended to focus on taking courses with particular faculty members that I'd heard fantastic things about, and I started out majoring in psychology and actually finished that major, but I was really interested in a lot of the personality theorists. Then I also dabbled in political science and comparative literature and art history and history itself, and took a lot of wonderful things. And it was at Brown at that time that I started becoming aware of different figures connected with the Frankfurt School. And it wasn't until my senior year that I really focused exclusively on them. There was a major at Brown called Modern Culture and Media that now is sort of more... it's more of a traditional communications and media production kind of major. But back when I was there, it was a very heavy media theory and cultural studies in its infancy kind of concentration. So a lot of people that I knew who had, I just kind of dabbled in it, and that's when I first read Walter Benjamin and Adorno. I'd already encountered Eric Fromm before. So I was familiar with these people, and I took a senior seminar with Abbot Gleason, who at the time was working on a book on the history of the concept of totalitarianism. And he wanted to talk to all of us before we began the seminar to see what kind of foreign language strengths we had, because he was interested in having people work on intellectual histories of various figures who made significant contributions to the concept in utilizing the concept of totalitarianism. So I went in and I talked about some of the things that I'd been studying and that I was curious about, and he said, well, this seems obvious then. You really need to work on Herbert Marcuse, mm-hmm. and focus on his use of totalitarianism. And, you know, I don't think it's going to be easygoing, especially in the context of a one semester seminar, but I think that based on what your interests are, that this would be very satisfying and fulfilling. And so that was, it was really kind of a baptism by fire. That was the first time that I read Martin Jay's Dialectical Imagination, and then I read some of what Jameson had to say about the Frankfurt School at the time, his book where he deals with Marcuse, Marxism and Form. And so I produced a seminar paper for that on Marcuse and really got bitten by the bug. I mean, it was kind of ironic because at the moment that the Cold War was kind of unraveling and coming to this very dramatic end, I was reading One Dimensional Man, and I just found it absolutely stirring because it provided this very different perspective and very different way for thinking about this world that I'd grown up in. Mm-hmm. So there was something really enormously interesting and fascinating to me about that. And I also thought that the language that Marcuse used was just, it was really stirring to me. And it was something that I really couldn't get out of my mind. I don't know how seriously I'd thought about going to graduate school until right around that time, but I loved working on this project. I loved working on him, and I kept thinking, I'm just curious about this group, and I want to keep reading them. So I finished up college, worked for a couple of years, and kept reading, and kept thinking about them, and couldn't really get it out of my mind. And it was several instructors from Brown who strongly advised me to seek out Paul Brynäs at Boston College, mm-hmm. who turned out to be the dissertation advisor for this project. And at the time, I had no idea. I just knew that I wanted to do something about the Frankfurt School. And I'll never forget the first day that I walked into Paul Brynäs' office. You know, I was familiar with him and knew that he was one of the people who really helped promote the Frankfurt School and awareness of the Frankfurt School in this country. So, it was thrilling to meet him and talk to him about it. And not surprisingly, of course, you know, I mean, this was years after he'd worked with Telos and been absolutely steeped in this whole tradition. I came in and he said, well, you know, I know a lot about all of that, but it's not really what I'm focused on myself all that much right now. But we can certainly do it. It'll be an interesting trip into my past. But it's not, you know, just so you know, so that was sort of the caveat that he gave me. But he turned out to be an enormously wonderful advisor, because he was able to really give me a lot of his time, a lot of his energy, and the project turned into a really big, complicated project. Had it been simply a piece of European intellectual history, that would have been hard all by itself. But then trying to get up to speed as much as I could on American intellectual history at the same time, I definitely needed some guidance and some help. And I was able to find, I mean, in addition to Paul Brynäs, there was also Alan Lawson that I worked really closely with at Boston College. Mm-hmm. And over the years, I've met numerous people that have been enormously influential as well. But that really is the beginning of my interest in all of this, and mm-hmm. and really the origins of the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you are like the I was going to say you are like that. You are the poster child for a good undergraduate and graduate experience.
Thank you.
A lot of the people I talk to are very bitter about both. But I will say this, though, a shout out to Brown University. I don't believe I've ever – I know I have a lot of friends that went to, you know, the schools back east, as they say. Mm-hmm. And uniformly, if they went to that big one in Boston, they say they had a bad time.
Yeah.
But uniformly, if they went to the nice one in Providence, they say they had a great time.
It's not like I'm doing an advertisement for Brown, but it's really true. I don't know anybody. I bump into people in the Boston area all the time who turned out to have gone to Brown, and I can't think of anybody who ever tells me, you know, I really hated it there. Yeah. They all are still starry-eyed about it. So,
That's terrific. That's the way the undergraduate experience should be. I went to a college here in Iowa, Grinnell College, and I had a great experience too. And I never fail to mention that I'm very grateful to them. But it's terrific having that engaging environment in Brown. I don't know how Brown does it exactly. I know Abbott Gleason; he's a terrific guy, and I love that particular book, the one on the origins of the idea and history of the idea of totalitarianism. Mm-hmm. So you really couldn't do better than him, I think. So let's talk about the book itself.
Sure.
I know a little bit about the topic. I probably know too much to be doing this interview, but let me ask some orientational questions. First of all, you call these people the Horkheimer Circle and not mm-hmm. so much the Frankfurt School. Why do you do that?
Well, I think part of when I, coming out of that atmosphere at Brown, I had a kind of almost caricature, almost a sort of mythic vision of them in my own mind, that they were this very tight-knit coterie, as the term Frankfurt School tends to imply, and then I had also assumed that they came. A lot of their story that they themselves told and helped to promote about being, this very isolated coterie that came here and was very influentially affected by what they saw and experienced here, but still, I mean, if anything, that their isolation helped enhance and kind of increase this kind of critical distance that they wanted to keep as observers, as critics, as theorists, as intellectuals. And it wasn't until the New Left came along that these messages and bottles that they sort of thought of as what their work really was. They had virtually no audience in their lifetime, that those messages and bottles were ultimately discovered on the beaches by young students in the late 1960s. So I think I use the term Horkheimer Circle because the actual picture that emerged of this group through all the archival work that I did was a lot more complex than that. I mean, for starters, the coherence of the group is a lot more complicated and problematic, both intellectually and institutionally. But then the other thing that I'm interested in doing is looking at them in connection with other intellectual circles of émigrés and looking at all of those émigrés navigating exile together. So rather than being isolated, I think that the Frankfurt School was able to sort of enjoy a brief period of kind of splendid isolation for a while, because they had a financial cushion to do that. But as soon as that got destroyed in the recession of the late 1930s, that kind of splendid isolation was no longer an option. And even before that, they weren't terribly isolated. I mean, they collaborated with a lot of people here in this country. Mm-hmm. So the idea that nobody knew about them, that nobody had heard about them, that's another thing that I'm attempting to question and problematize. So I felt it, to me, it seemed important to move away from the traditional label and category that we use and maybe introduce something a little bit different to kind of indicate the fact that it's really a different picture that emerges from the vantage point that I'm looking at this group from.
Tell us about Horkheimer.
Max Horkheimer was a brilliant guy. He was also a very savvy diplomat. I think that he had a tremendous amount of charisma, and I think that no matter what he had to do to guide this institution through all of the hazards and perils of exile, he still maintained the really intense loyalty of an incredibly bright and independently minded group of people. And to keep all of that together and to make all of them feel as though they were they all shared in this enormously important project, both for themselves, but also really for German intellectual life and Western intellectual life. I think that took an enormous amount of charisma, but also an enormous amount of diplomacy. He obviously, there were times when he misread situations. There were times where he obviously antagonized people, sometimes knowing that he was going to do that, sometimes not knowing that he was going to do that. But I think he's a fascinating person, and they're actually John Abramite, who teaches at Buffalo State. Mm-hmm. He's working on a biography of Horkheimer that is absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's to my knowledge, it's the most thorough treatment of Horkheimer's career that I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. It's really amazing.
Maybe you could tell us about Horkheimer's background and the background of the other members of the school in a kind of, to use a fancy historical word, a prosopographical way. Do they share things in common? How did the institute get started? Why the affiliation in Frankfurt and that sort of thing?
Well, I'd say that the key event that all of them shared in their lives is that they were all young men, roughly in their 20s, when the First World War came to an end and the revolutions of 1918 and 1919 took place. So, I mean, that's an enormously pivotal moment in a person's life. All of them came from generally upper middle class families. Some of them were the sons of industrialists and factory owners and entrepreneurs. Some of them were the children of urban professionals. But all of them were totally transformed by what happened in 1918 and 1919. All of them had a very emotional reaction to the Wilhelmine society that they'd grown up in. So all of them had various moral qualms and problems with it, the conformity of it, some of the injustices of it, and then when you throw the experiences of the First World War on top of all of that, this idea of barbarism lying mm-hmm. not so far beneath the surface. So mm-hmm. when those revolutions swept across Germany, I think that all of them were really terribly surprised and terribly excited to witness what was happening. I mean, it really seemed like anything might be possible. And I think that the council movements, for an awful lot of them, were this incredibly liberating and exciting development. And then to see all of that get washed away by the counter-revolutions that swept up in the wake of all of that, I think was very disillusioning, frightening. Horkheimer and Pollock were in Munich, so they saw the repression of all of that up close. And Marcuse was in Berlin, mm-hmm. and so he saw he was there for the Spartacist winter, and it's something that he talked a lot about for the rest of his life. It was something that was the image of revolution that he imagined in his mind. So the idea that the world could be changed in very progressive ways was something that was never far from their minds. But then thinking about how all of that was snuffed out, that really became then the life work of all of them. So they all were dedicated to formulating a comprehensive theory of bourgeois society, and to really move beyond the classically orthodox Marxist and even to some extent some of the Western Marxist assumptions about the role of the working class and the evolving consciousness of the working class. They wanted to ultimately ultimately marry social philosophy and empirical social science together to weld those two forces together to comprehend what was going on, to develop a comprehensive social theory of contemporary society, the society that they were watching. Mm-hmm. So one of the very first things that they did was to study the German working class and to figure out what was really going on with them. And the results of that were unbelievably discouraging to them, but not terribly surprising based on some of the events that they'd seen. So, as far as why Frankfurt was selected, there were, one of their, the prime founder and mover, who created the Frankfurt School, Felix Weil, he had been a student and had also similarly witnessed all of this, and the University of Frankfurt was one of the more progressive newer universities in Germany that also had a very rapidly growing social science faculty, and they wanted to create an institute like this that would dedicate itself to making sense of what was going on from sort of this left perspective.
I'm sorry, I have to ask this. Is this Weil related to Hermann Weil?
Yeah, Hermann Weil was his father.
Oh, really?
Hermann Weil was a grain merchant in the import export business.
Yeah, because the reason I mentioned is because my wife's a mathematician, so she
okay. Knows
Hermann Weil is. So then I have to ask this though, because it is curious. They're almost to a person Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
I think all of them had they had a relationship to Judaism that is sort of classically German in some respects. George Massey is the author who pops foremost into my mind about all of this. There's a long tradition of Bildung in Germany, and Massey wrote this very short but very smart little book called German Jews Beyond Judaism, in which he really argues that to some extent it's the legacy of the Enlightenment. It has this this very powerful impact on Germany's Jews, this desire for a pluralist, cosmopolitan society, a republic of letters, that would transcend aristocracy, that would transcend religious divisions. If you accept that theory, then that may be part of why there were such an enormous number of very highly assimilated German Jews that constituted the core of this institute. But there were also a lot of non-Jews. Mm-hmm. Well, not a lot, but Karl Wittvogel probably most notably comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, but the thing that's complicated about it is that some of them enacted forms of, I don't want to get too Freudian about it, but almost Oedipal acts of rebellion. I mean, Erich Fromm and Leo Lowenthal, they both spent time with the Lehrhaus in Frankfurt, which was a kind of orthodox community. But both of them talked about the fact that it made their parents crazy. And in fact, Adorno, who knew Lowenthal at the time, Adorno's father said, "Oh, stay away from that guy. You know, I don't know what I really think about some of this." So it's, you know, the relationship to Judaism is enormously interesting, but it's also very, very complicated.
Yeah, I find it very interesting. There is something there.
No, for sure.
There's no question there's something there. I was talking to somebody else I interviewed, Joel Lewis, about this, and he studied Jewish immigrants to the United States from 1890 to the 1930s, particularly socialists. And one of the things that he pointed out was that at that time, people who were in the believing Jewish community, let's call it that, were afraid that Judaism was going to die.
Yeah,
because nobody was going to synagogue. Nobody, mm. no, everybody was totally deracinated. They were all assimilating like crazy, and people were like, "The jig is up. The game is over. This is you know, Judaism as we knew it is gonna vanish from the face of the earth." And it's interesting from an American's perspective now, because we can't imagine that, because Judaism is so thriving in the United States, and not to mention the existence of Israel. But it's just interesting to think about that moment in history between roughly, I don't know, the late 19th, early 20th century, where people were thinking, you know, especially Europeans and especially these assimilated Jews, whether the project was even going to continue as it had. And clearly it was breaking in two ways at the time. I mean, in one sense, people were heading to Palestine to do it the old way. Yeah. And then other people, you know, thought those people were nuts and were, you know, they basically were, you know, they didn't believe anymore. They just didn't believe anymore. And so they were looking for other things. I think that it's a really fascinating sociological phenomenon.
It sure is. And, you know, certainly I think with this group, it was, you know, as soon as you're being persecuted for being Jewish, that's part of the reason why you're in exile in the first place. And then you start hearing about, you know, some of what the Nazis are doing to friends and relatives back home. You know, to what degree you thought of yourself as Jewish in the past, you're thinking they very rapidly began to think of themselves as Jewish. And so I think, you know, to some degree, they do have a kind of, some of them, you know, and again, this is where the uniformity of the group is somewhat problematic, but some of them, to varying degrees, have something comparable to what some of the New York intellectuals went through, which is, you know, once the Second World War happens, once some of the revelations of the Holocaust become clearer and clearer, there is kind of, for many of them, this return and kind of an engagement with what does it mean to be Jewish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no.
Whether or not you ever felt like it had an impact on your life in the past, it does now. And, you know, I mean, Trilling very famously said, you know, they did one of these symposiums where they collected people responding to the question, you know, what is being Jewish meant to you as an intellectual? And Trilling said, you know, I mean, really nothing. I'm sure that it's affected me in some way, but it's not something I'm self-consciously aware of. And you know, I mean, obviously once the war happened, that was a position that increasingly became more and more untenable for people. And, you know, I mean, in part, that's part of the reason why anti-Semitism became a huge sociological focus for them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was something that personally was very relevant to them on a whole number of scores. But you know, I mean, certainly how it intersected with their own biographies is that can't be ignored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, let's actually follow up on that. It's a nice segue to the next moment, and that is they're coming to the United States. They actually fled the Nazis, did they not?
Yeah, they did. They made a brief interim stop in Geneva. They sort of foresaw problems coming, and Horkheimer, I mean, this is one of these you know, decisions where he really seems to have been an unbelievably astute administrator. He started moving all of their finances out of Germany and trying to move as many of their resources into Switzerland, and where he felt that they'd be safe. And once he got it all moved into Switzerland, you know, the Nazis very rapidly, they came to power, and this was one of the first institutions that they wanted to shut down. So they were very, very fortunate in that regard. And then, but I don't think that any of them thought that Switzerland was going to be a satisfactory long-term place of refuge. So they were immediately already looking beyond and thinking where else to go. And very rapidly, the United States started seeming like the safest option that they could envision.
I have to ask, why not given the given German Anglophilia? I don't know if the Germans are Anglophiles anymore, but they used to be. Why not England?
It's a good question, and I have to say, I think they did. You know, I mean, they did wind up having a branch office in England, but I think that they feared that the kinds of opportunities and the kind of already entrenched academic culture that they would have a tougher time making inroads there than they would here. If they wanted the kind of institutional affiliation to basically continue doing what they were doing in Frankfurt, to basically replicate that as closely as they could, I think that they thought that that being someplace here, they would have the best opportunity to do something like that. So, but you know, they had people going all over the place, exploring different possibilities. But the quickest, most positive responses that they got were here in this country. And
Why did they end up in New York and not Iowa City, let's say?
Right. Well, I mean, Chicago, they could have very easily wound up in Chicago, but the kind of arrangement that Columbia offered to them, I think, you know, in part they wanted to be in New York because it was a little bit closer to Europe, and it was a place that you know, from Europe, they knew a lot about. I mean, it still was kind of this iconic American city for them. But also the kind of arrangement that Columbia was offering, they thought would afford them the kind of situation that they were seeking out. What's more mysterious, their motivations to me have always been somewhat clear. Columbia's motivations were always kind of the more mysterious piece of the puzzle. I mean, what would Columbia, which the president of Columbia at the time was Nicholas Murray Butler, what did they see in the Frankfurt School? That is what to me was a more surprising and in some ways complicated thing to uncover. But a lot of that had to do with all the way back before the Depression, sociologists at Columbia had in mind creating a kind of institution like eventually Paul Lazarsfeld built with the Bureau of Applied Social Research. So, and initially, I mean, as bizarre as it sounds, the Frankfurt School was initially seen as an organization that might be able to serve the kind of function that Paul Lazarsfeld later did. Now, in the case of Lazarsfeld, Columbia got more than it ever bargained for. So, I mean, they got a very powerful and shrewd researcher that created an institution that really wound up developing a kind of gravitational pull of its own and an institutional life of its own. In the case of the Frankfurt School, I think they got less than what they bargained for. I mean, I think that they looked at the kinds of really big sociological research projects that Eric Fromm had been directing and then ultimately contracting out with different research teams all over Europe, and they thought, well, you know, this is fantastic. And some of that continued until Fromm and the Institute parted ways. And then the rest of the Institute got exposed for a lot of what it was, which was a group of people that were interested in, as I mentioned before, welding empiricism and social philosophy together. But the main person who was instrumental in that welding process and bridging the empirical with the social philosophical, he was gone. So trying to replace that, they didn't have a lot of time to do that, and they wound up frustrating a lot of their main allies and sponsors at Columbia in the meantime. So, Paul Lazarsfeld, I think, was brought in in an attempt to finally deliver what Columbia had been looking for. And they got it in spades, like I said. But it made the Institute's presence at Columbia no longer desired or even necessary. So they really hung on through the 1940s. And were it not for them being able to secure grant support for this massive project of anti-Semitism that ultimately resulted in five monographs, a whole series called The Studies in Prejudice, that is really the work that cemented their place in American sociology. So that was an enormously important development, but to some extent their success came a little bit too late. Lazarsfeld, right out of the gate, was landing big projects like this. The most famous early project that he was working on was this massive study of radio that was really, I mean, like The Studies in Prejudice, was very pioneering work. But, you know, he had a lot to show for that by the early 1940s. And the Frankfurt School, Studies in Prejudice didn't come out until 1950. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in some ways, that delay that occurred with the departure of Eric Fromm really was a huge, huge setback for them institutionally as far as Columbia was concerned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think this is something that is forgotten. We talked a little bit in the pre-interview about the current image of the Frankfurt School or the Horkheimer Circle, mm-hmm. and it is strongly associated with what we might call critical theory, and they even called critical theory. But I was surprised to read in your book, because I really didn't know, that these people were really empirical social scientists at the beginning, and that we shouldn't forget that. They were handing out surveys and conducting really sort of, I would call it almost positivist sort of social science. Go ahead.
It's interesting because in Germany that, it's been overshadowed, but you talk to anybody who was studying sociology in Germany, in the 60s or earlier for that matter, and they went back to Germany as ambassadors of American research methods and empiricism. So, I mean, on the one hand, it's kind of bizarre because they went back as ambassadors for American social science, and yet on the other hand, they never their problem with American social science was if it never has the capacity to interrogate the status quo, then it's not of very much use. That's where social theory comes into the picture. Ultimately, they became, at the same time that they were teaching American empirical research methods to their students in Frankfurt during the 1950s and 1960s, at the same time, they have these unbelievably explosive debates. Most famous is Adorno and Karl Popper debating positivism. And so they became some of the most articulate critics at the same time of empiricism and of positivism and social science.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it is kind of this this interesting dynamic, and I would say that's why not everybody in Germany is aware of the fact, tends to think of critical theory just as you explained it, but there are some older sociologists are definitely aware of this very vital role that they played in basically rebuilding sociology in Germany after the war.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Why did now, many of our listeners are going to have heard, especially if they're a little bit older, like I am, of Eric Fromm. Well, why did he leave?
There were a whole host of disputes. Some of them were intellectual, and those were very serious differences. Fromm was a Freudian revisionist, and some of that revisionism was necessary and useful to Horkheimer and some of the other leading theoreticians in the Institute, because to make Freudian psychoanalysis useful for sociological research, that did mean making some theoretical revisions. But Fromm continued to make revisions, and I think that some of the other members of the Institute got into some serious disputes with him about not wanting to modify some of the instinct and drive theories that they thought Freud was absolutely correct about. So So that was a very serious intellectual debate that wasn't going to easily be resolved. In addition to that, though, in exile, Horkheimer did seek to have people around him who he felt were totally committed to the Institute and were totally loyal to the Institute. And I think the thing that bothered him about Erich Fromm is that Erich Fromm was committed to the Institute, but he also had a private practice. He was very connected to psychoanalysts all over the United States. He had important contacts in Chicago, and he wasn't shy about making lots of contacts on Morningside Heights and elsewhere in New York City. So that was another area of friction. And then ultimately when the Institute started thinking about having to scale back and cut back its operating expenses, Fromm seemed like a very obvious candidate for doing something like that, not because what he was contributing to the Institute was not valued, but because he had a capacity to earn money as a private analyst, which was something that not a lot of other scholars connected with the Institute had. So for a whole number of reasons, Fromm was approached to have his salary cut. And not surprisingly, he was infuriated by this. So that ultimately was the final straw in shattering that relationship. So Fromm left with a sizable severance package, and he was done with them. And mm-hmm. they, to a large extent, were done with him. And I think if Fromm is often forgotten by people who think about the Frankfurt School, some of it may have to do with the fact that he left as early as he did, but then also he wasn't talked about a lot or remembered much by members of the Institute as they were telling their story at the moment that they became famous in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. So, I can see why they might have forgotten him. He was something of a self-promoter, but the thing that really fascinated me about him is he gets to the United States, or it might have happened even earlier, but there's some story to be told about his interaction with the publishing world, because he learned that if he wrote what are basically self-help books, he could make a fortune.
That's right.
Because he was the Dr. Phil of his day.
Yeah, he was. The Art of Loving is the most famous of all those.
I can only imagine that these guys, these sort of hard-bitten Marxists of the German haute bourgeoisie read this stuff and were just, this wasn't on. I mean, and then he moved to California.
Yeah.
It was the whole thing. I mean, they probably thought he'd just gone nuts. Did they begin to look down their nose at him, or?
I don't know that they ever looked down their nose at any of their former colleagues. They always looked at them with a certain amount of wariness, and they always feared cabals forming of various former colleagues that were disgruntled. And they were very aware of the fact that, their American friends, if word spreads within enough intellectual networks in the United States about us that's negative, that's not something that we necessarily want to see. So they actually spent a lot of time, at least during the 40s. I mean, once Fromm became more of the self-help guru more in the 50s and 60s, I don't think that they were really worried about him or thinking about him at that point. But in the 40s, his big book, Escape from Freedom, that actually is pretty consistent with what the Frankfurt School was working on. It certainly is a lot more accessible, and it's in some ways theoretically a little less rigorous than what the Institute was doing. But I think for a lot of Americans, that was an enormously important book in helping to articulate some of what the Institute had been working on. So how the themes of conformity, totalitarianism, and even to some degree mass culture all converge. So I think the reputation that Fromm developed, that some of that may have really more taken shape in the 50s. I remember talking to H. Stuart Hughes before I did a lot of oral histories in connection with this book, and he and Peter Gay had very similar reactions to what you're describing, to your reaction about Fromm, that he really became a lot less serious. And in some ways that has a lot to do with why The rest of the Frankfurt School was of a lot of use to the New Left in the 1960s, but Fromm really just wasn't picked up. I mean, he was too mainstream. He was too commercial. In some ways, he'd become too much of a mass media commodity in some respects to really be taken seriously as a countercultural figure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So then they make their way through the war, and a lot of them work for the OSS or for the Department of State or something like this. And then the war ends, and they have the opportunity to go back, and some of them do and some of them don't.
Right, which was a very touchy issue for a lot of them. I think that Horkheimer became very happy with the downsized institute that resulted from all of the problems and turbulence of exile. So some of them felt quite betrayed by him, but some of them also started realizing that there were opportunities that existed for them in this country. But it's interesting, as many opportunities as opened up for Herbert Marcuse, for example, he always, I think right up until the end, he always entertained this thought of maybe going back to Frankfurt. And ironically, by the same token, I think when Horkheimer and Adorno and Pollock all got back, being exiles that had returned, the responsibilities of what they saw their role as in terms of rebuilding sociology, of being a moral voice for the younger generation, in terms of carrying on some of the Weimar intellectual traditions, I think that the realities of actually carrying that out and living day to day in what was still a fairly conservative academic culture that hadn't been as denazified as many of them might have wished, that turned out to be very difficult for some of them. So at the same time that Marcuse, for example, always sort of held in the back of his mind that it might be interesting to someday go back to Frankfurt, I think that Horkheimer and Pollock in particular always thought, well, maybe we'll go back to the United States at some point. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. It's an interesting dynamic that I think speaks to the fact that, as Martin Jay famously used the phrase as the title for his first book of essays, after the dialectical imagination, they were permanent exiles. That exile was not, that was a condition that never really changed, because you can never go back. It never really. So.
Mm-hmm. So then Marcuse stays in the United States, right?
Yes, absolutely.
He does. Yeah, he's in the United States. And then I was very interested. I think this is one of the most fascinating parts of your book. Maybe you could tell the story about how Marcuse became someone he really didn't want to be.
I want to just explain to you how, because this was not something I expected. This again speaks to the whole reason why I tend to use the term Horkheimer Circle a lot more than I use Frankfurt School. When I knew that I wanted to finish up the book talking about Marcuse and the American New Left, because that's really the moment that Marcuse becomes internationally famous, and by extension, the whole Frankfurt School becomes internationally famous. And I had expected to go into the archives and to look at all the papers of SDS. I wanted to use SDS as sort of the main, because it was the largest of all the student organizations. But then I also went through hundreds and hundreds of these underground newspapers that were published also during the late 1960s and 70s. And my expectation was that Marcuse was complicated enough that you would find quite a bit of writing and discussion and analysis, people trying to wrestle with what he was talking about, what it was that he was offering to the New Left. And I thought that it actually might provide an interesting vantage point, again, following this line of looking at receptions of critical theory and of the Frankfurt School in exile and in the United States, that maybe it would help to help identify some of the fault lines that were sort of built into the New Left from its inception. And to my great surprise, there really wasn't a whole lot of discussion about Marcuse at all, and it was this agonizing experience where I'd be going into the archives every day expecting to be finding all kinds of wonderful pieces of information, and I just kept coming up with nothing. But I started realizing very rapidly that that in and of itself was a really interesting story.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I started, what did become clear is that there were tiny pockets of people. I followed all this up with oral histories, by the way, because I found the written record to be so unbelievably surprising that it then became obvious that I really need to go and talk to some people who were sort of at the center of all of this to find out what they think about all of what I'm finding. So at any rate, what did eventually become clear is that it was really 1968 that put Marcuse on the map. So he was at the moment that the student uprisings took place in Paris and in Rome, and really all over the world. You think of 68 as it really was this incredibly dramatic year. There were these posters that appeared in Rome and in Paris that proclaimed that basically celebrated the names Marx, Mao, and Marcuse. And so you have to imagine these reporters who are observing these protests. And so Marx and Mao are familiar to everybody, but then Marcuse, who the heck is that? And much to their surprise, it turns out to be a philosophy professor at the University of California, San Diego, who's about 70 years old and seems to be the most unlikely figure imaginable to be at the center of this whirlwind. The other thing that I'd always been kind of puzzled about Marcuse in the era of the New Left is that, you know, when you look at his speeches from the time period and you look at his theoretical writings and monographs from the time period, his own position vacillates a lot from being very encouraging and excited and enthusiastic about what's happening with the New Left to it could be months later where he really is hammering the New Left for a lot of what's going on within its ranks. Mm-hmm. And I'd always been, and then also, you know, how do third world liberation movements fit into the picture? How does civil rights fit into the picture? How do some of these various socioeconomic relief programs that also grew out of SDS, how do those fit into the picture? It's a very confusing path that he walks. And gradually what I came to discover is that I really think that in some respects, I think that Marcuse became a media celebrity in 1968. I think that he was aware of that. And if you look at his statements and comments from that time period, it is something that he reflects on and talks about. And I think that he was very aware of the fact that by becoming a commodity at that moment, that it was going to diminish and contort him and the kind of impact that he might have. At the same time, I think that he was thrilled about what he saw going on with the student movement, but also at various times unbelievably concerned. So I think that rather than Marcuse being the guru or father figure or maybe even grandfather figure of the New Left, that there may be a way in which the New Left may have meant more to Marcuse than he actually meant to the New Left. And what I mean by that is that I think that they provided a kind of confirmation for a lot of what he had been working on theoretically up until that point. So if you look at two of Marcuse's most famous books that he wrote in the United States, one of them is obviously One Dimensional Man, which is unbelievably bleak, incredibly pessimistic. It's a kind of nightmare vision of not just American society, but the fact that there's no hope in America, there's no hope in the East with the communist societies, and there really isn't any hope in the third world. We're living, and he ends the book by citing Walter Benjamin, saying, you know, it is for the sake of those without hope that hope is given to us. You know, what an amazingly depressing way to end this very wide-ranging analysis of advanced industrial society.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if you juxtapose that with his Freud book, Eros and Civilization, that is a much more markedly optimistic book. how did he reconcile, I mean, how did he generate these two visions of the future? I think in some ways the New Left, they represented the kind of hopefulness that he had for non-repressive developments arising from within this highly repressive technological society. Mm-hmm. And so these tensions that he had with the student movement, on the one hand worrying they're not intellectual enough, they're not serious enough, they're not committed enough to seeing the big picture, to liberating their own consciousness. But then on the other hand, sometimes thinking, yeah, but what they understand on an instinctual level is that they are living in a society that is irrational, that is wasteful, that is destructive, and they feel all of this on a daily basis. It's part of what is creating their sense of disillusionment and alienation and dissatisfaction in a society that at the same time is unbelievably affluent. So these are not exactly people that you would expect, perhaps, to feel such tensions, but yet they do. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. So that is sort of the what to me were real revelations about Marcuse. And I think in some sense, the more we can get past the media construction that arose about him, there's a way in which not only does it sort of free up his thought for us to go back and think about and take seriously and to re-examine, but it really allows you to do that with the whole first generation of the Frankfurt School, with the whole Horkheimer circle, because they all it's at that moment that the Frankfurt School goes from being a West German media term to becoming a media term, not a very widespread media term, obviously, but it's at that point that this idea of a Frankfurt School really comes to America and comes to the United States and comes to the English-speaking world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to just mention en passant that, and you point this out in the book, I think, that what the initial thinkers and students on the New Left were reading was, I think, C. Wright Mills, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
And it's funny because I interviewed John Summers. I don't know if you know John, but
I do.
Yeah, isn't he writing the biography of C. Wright Mills?
He is, yeah.
Yeah, no,
I'm really excited.
Yeah, no, I want to read that. Yeah, because I've read C. Wright Mills, and I think he's actually quite brilliant. And I can see why they read him. It's easier to understand than Marcuse, or at least was for me. So, yeah, it's interesting how in the mists of time we tend to forget these people, because people are still really carrying the torch for Marcuse and critical theory. I mean, if you read the introduction to any critical theory book, and now there are critical theory departments and cultural studies and so on and so forth, it will be, you'll hear a lot about the Frankfurt School. I think it's because it's convenient. It's a tag you can throw at it. But you don't really hear as much about, you're sort of a Christopher Lash and especially C. Wright Mills, who I think is largely forgotten today, unfortunately. But he was he was extraordinarily important at the time. And I think that your book does a good job of pointing that out. And I hope that we can continue once John's book comes out, this corrective. So let me ask you this. What is the – this is a big question. Mm-hmm. What is the legacy of the Frankfurt School today?
I think, one of the first and in my mind, all of these are legacies that they contributed to. They didn't invent them. But one of their legacies and one of the reasons for their significance, I think, particularly in the academy, is that they helped articulate very well the problematic between empirical research and qualitative research, so theory and positivism, if you will,
mm-hmm.
traditional theory and critical theory, to quote the terms that Horkheimer used to describe that distinction. That is, that is a debate that they had been participating in Germany. That is a debate that they continued participating in when they were in exile. But it's a debate that, I mean, as you point out, part of the reason why they show up in sociology textbooks, for example, is because they were able to clarify an alternative to empirical sociology. So critical sociology, if you want to use that term to describe an alternative mode of thought just in the field of sociology. But, I mean, this could apply to other fields as well beyond sociology. I mean, certainly as a historian, there is a harder, more empirical branch of history, social history, and then more humanistic, qualitative branches of the discipline as well, which mm-hmm. as an intellectual historian and cultural historian, that's, you know, that obviously is squarely where I put myself.
Mm-hmm.
So beyond the academic resonance, they also had some significant public intellectual resonance. So one of the most significant contributions that they made for Americans was by integrating ultimately the concepts of mass culture and totalitarianism together into a kind of cultural Marxist critique of advanced industrial civilization and society. And those aesthetic criticisms have never really gone away. People had always, people since the founding of the country had always been worried about popular culture. And with the rise of mass culture, some of these people were conservative critics, some of these people were communists, some of these people were progressives. But what the Frankfurt School was able to contribute was a way of looking at this phenomenon in a much more nuanced and socially sociologically rich manner. So mass culture was not simply a product of big business interests in the entertainment world. It was also a symptom of much larger historical changes that were taking place in the world. And for that reason, it was something that merited very serious attention. So that's another whole angle. And then I think also ultimately the role of intellectuals in society. Ultimately when the New Left arose in the late 1960s, Marcuse made a choice to be to not be on the sidelines, to be committed and to pick sides, to choose sides, and to become a partisan in that sense.
Yeah.
Adorno, by contrast, I mean, the two exchanged these unbelievable letters throughout the 60s in which they debated the merits and the pitfalls of the New Left. And Adorno was, well, he sympathized tremendously with a lot of what the New Left was provoked by. At the same time, he had his misgivings were so serious that he just felt as though he had to be a lot more careful in terms of taking sides. And he never saw it as so simply clear cut. And he used to worry aloud in these letters to Marcuse, you know, make sure that you're thinking as critically as you can about all of this. So to some degree, it also gets to the whole question of what is the role of the intellectual. I mean, to some degree, critical theory raises the idea that the intellectual must and should always be politically and socially committed. That is what an intellectual is supposed to do. But on the other hand, at times, they also promoted an idea that in certain circumstances, the intellectual has the capacity to see more by occupying a more detached and isolated position
mm-hmm.
In relation to contemporary society and political movements.
Mm-hmm.
So this was one of these contested issues that they debated about, but in debating about it among themselves, I mean, this is also one of these classic issues that American intellectuals have also wrestled with themselves. So I think that's another piece of this whole legacy.
Yeah, I'm almost at a loss for words about what to say, what I think about their legacy. But one thing that is pretty clear to me is that Insofar as we have public intellectuals in the United States, they're very different than the public intellectuals that were around in the in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Oh, I mean, if you think about it, for example, I mean, they had, well, you know, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. and Christopher Lash and, you know, Eric Hobsbawm, and that's just the people on the left, and C. Wright Mills and these people. We have Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah, I know.
Who says, you know, kind of clever things about tricks of human psychology or wisdom of crowds, or I don't know what it is exactly, but it seems to me that the intellectuals that we have around today are the intellectual rigor is still there. It's largely in the academy, but it's completely detached from any political program at all.
Yeah.
I mean,
I
see it around me all the time. Actually, it's funny because John Summers is different in that way, and he's gotten some heat for it. But, I mean, if you think about the people who we think of as public intellectuals, I don't know, Andrew Sullivan or something, they're bloggers. And you can't really think deeply in 500 words that you have to write four times a day. You can't really have a program. I don't know exactly what that medium does to thought, but I can't think that it's a terribly good thing. It's all very, I don't know. I could be completely wrong about this.
No,
but
well,
it just strikes me that the public, that the people that, you know, even Eric Fromm. I mean, Dr. Eric Fromm, Dr. Phil is no Eric Fromm.
Yeah,
he just isn't. You know,
no question.
And
it's interesting because at the same time that you see this transformation or retreat, if you will, of public intellectuals within the academy, the rigor and intensity that traditions like critical theory are dissected and reexamined and continued, perpetuated. But that's going on within largely seminar rooms.
No, it is. That's right. No, I think that's exactly right. It never gets out of the seminar room, and in fact, that's bad for it because it never gets purified in that way. So if you read some of this stuff now, it's, you know, it's impenetrable, really. I don't know if I should wish for a world in which, I don't know, Michel Foucault or something is read by the masses, but I do kind of wish that Christopher Lash was still around,
or
C. Wright Mills, or one of these guys. I don't know who it would be today, and I'm sure one of our listeners will call me up and say, yeah, well, it's this person. You should read this person. But it's not Dinesh D'Souza, and it's not Ann Coulter, and it's not Al Franken. These people just simply, as wonderful as they are, and I, you know, very much respect the talents that they have, but the level of intellectual discourse that I think once, or the sense of possibility, really, that existed in the 1960s and 70s, the sense of possibility and the sense of engagement that came of these things is now largely gone. I don't know. Maybe that's a good thing. I'm a relatively conservative person myself, but I don't know. It just seems like the stakes are incredibly low now for any intellectual. There just really isn't anybody who's saying, you know, this has to change or this is all wrong or this is, you know, I mean, it's funny because I tend to be a little bit Republican myself, I'll admit that. But, you know, from the perspective of someone on the political sort of center right, Barack Obama's great. He's wonderful. I love the guy. So things have really changed, I think.
Absolutely. And you know, it makes me wonder sometimes, you know, they were – the Frankfurt School, while it was promoting these ideas, was savaged by certain people and still is its legacy for being very elitist in some ways, of not giving – the broader population enough credit, but it does make you wonder a little bit if it's not that there aren't more people that would be willing to be public intellectuals. It's just that marketplace has really shrunk down to something quite small, where you know, the kinds of, you know, you look at something like Dan Brown, which has a certain kind of, I don't know, I mean, intellectual cachet. It's sort of like a much, much tamer version of some of what Umberto Eco, you know, you think of Foucault's Pendulum, has produced. It's got something in common with that, and it, that sells, you know. So it's not as though people aren't curious, but the what they want to put themselves through, the amount of energy that they want to put into it, may not be the same. And Adorno used to worry that he talked about regression, you know, I mean, that you can have intellectual regression, you can have aesthetic regression, and it's not among cultural producers, it's among the receptive audience that's out there that wants to engage with these kinds of things.
Yeah, well, you've given me, this discussion has given me an idea. Maybe you and and I and John Summers should have a little round table.
That'd be great.
I think it would be great. I did my first conference call with three people. It's a sort of three-person interview in which everybody was in different places last week, and it turned out really well, so it would be entirely possible. And I know John has some really interesting things to say about this, and I do find it interesting myself. I mean, I tend to be sort of a unreconstructed empiricist and positivist, mm-hmm. but nonetheless, I do – you know, I don't know, maybe it's professional jealousy. I don't know what it is, but I do look at the people that I guess are public intellectuals, and I think, you know, I just would really like to think we can do better. And that's why it's so terrific to talk to people like you and John Summers again, because you guys are really engaged with this stuff. And again, I study 16th and 17th century Russia, so I don't know how engaged I can be, but I remember in the 1980s when I was in college, and I was really quite the socialist and loved Marxism and the whole mm-hmm. thing and how engaged I was in it. But then I look at my students today, and I don't know what they're engaged in. I really don't know. And they're very intelligent people.
Yeah.
They're terrific students.
Right.
But I don't know what lights their fire. I cannot mm-hmm. figure it out. Anyway, we have taken up a huge amount of your time, Tom. I could talk about this stuff all day long. Why don't you tell us what your next project is? This is our traditional final question on New Books in History.
I'm working on a project with David Kettler, who has written extensively about Karl Mannheim. We're working on a project on Franz Neumann. Franz Neumann was a political scientist connected with the Frankfurt School. He was also a very prominent lawyer in the Weimar Republic before he emigrated. And David actually studied with Neumann as a graduate student at Columbia. So it's a project that's very near and dear to his heart, and he's been collecting material on Neumann for years. And I have certainly spent a lot of time wrestling with Neumann as I've worked on this project. And of all of the figures connected with the Frankfurt School, in some ways, they're just, especially in the English-speaking world, there just hasn't been enough. He hasn't gotten his due. And I think that he you want to talk about C. Wright Mills and people like Robert Lind. When you look back at who they thought was one of the most exciting people involved in the Frankfurt School back in the 40s, they all say Franz Neumann.
Yeah, but he wrote Behemoth, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
It was a big hit. It was a big – people read that thing like crazy.
Unbelievably important book, and yet he has been – unfortunately, increasingly forgotten by a lot of people.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we're really interested in doing is trying to revive interest in him, because both of us think that obviously we think that he's an enormously important figure for this era, and for a lot of people that go on to become enormously important public intellectuals in this country. So that in part is what we're going to be seeking to do.
Yeah, I could talk to you all day. I read Behemoth a long time ago, and I remember reading it thinking it was just a fantastic book.
Mm-hmm.
And
it is.
It was written in the middle of it, really. You know, I mean, he had great perspective on it. So anyway, that's absolutely terrific project, and we'll have to have you on when you finish the book. And I'll be in touch about talking to you and John about historians and public intellectuals. But anyway, let me thank you. We've been talking to Tom Wheatland about his terrific book, The Frankfurt School in Exile. And Tom, thank you very much for being on the show.
Marshall, thank you so much. I enjoyed it immeasurably.
Okay, all right. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Tom Wheatland about his new book, The Frankfurt School in Exile. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.